I'm now going to read to you from Daniel chapter 3. It's on page 840 in the Church Bibles. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisers, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisers, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If the God we serve is able to deliver us, then he will deliver us from the blazing furnace and from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual, and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, Your Majesty." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed. And the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Thank you, Christy. I've been thinking about this particular story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego going into the fiery furnace. And it seems to me it's a story mainly about compromise. I'll explain what I mean as we go along. But first of all, I want to ask that question about when is it that you would bow down? Often in certain cultures, you would bow on meeting people. At our last church, we had a large South Korean population in the area, and many of them came and worshipped at our church. And every time that you met, you would bow. It was part of their culture. It's true of many places in the Far East. So when President Obama went and met the Emperor of Japan, he bowed. Inevitably, given that President Obama is something of a divisive figure in the United States, there were those who decided that this was treason. After all, we'd beaten the Japanese, and presidents shouldn't bow to anyone. They had similar reactions when he met with the Saudi king and bowed to him as well. Both explained by the State Department as well, actually, this is what you do. This is observing protocol and local customs. But in those situations, you bow down. If you were to meet someone in royalty, you would bow. If you were in service to someone, you might at times bow as a mark of that relative position between you and them. If you're in a show and you get to the end of the performance, you have served well, you receive the applause, and you bow. These days there are two situations that I find myself bowing. The first of those, which for me still happens, is when I'm taking a funeral. There is a custom that certainly for the funeral directors, the person officiating in the funeral, as the coffin is brought in and placed on the dais or wherever it happens to be, you bow, a mark of respect to the person that has died. And in my previous employment, when I was working in the courts, every time that the judge would come in to start a session, he would bow or she would bow to the court would bow to them as a sign of mutual respect for the institution, for justice. Most of those, I suspect, seem relatively unexceptional and probably unobjectionable. Another situation where people may be expected to bow, I saw this image in North Korea, where people were faced with a statue of Kim Jong-un, and they bowed to him, almost in a godlike status. And probably most of us would balk at that. But then he's not our leader, it's not our state. And as foreigners, there would probably be a different expectation on us. But as I've thought about this passage, I've wondered, well, what is the difference between bowing down to this statue as an embodiment of the state and bowing in court, recognising the state institution of justice? Is there a difference? Are both wrong? Was President Obama wrong, as his critics said, to bow to foreign rulers? Where does Scripture come in? For example, the second commandment, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. How do we deal with things like that? For Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, they were faced with this dilemma of how to respond to the statue covered by this edict from Nebuchadnezzar. We don't know whether this is a statue of a god or a statue of himself. But clearly what was being asked was bow down and worship. And I think there are three responses that they could have had. The first one was to accept defeat. They were the people of Judah. They had been defeated. In the culture of the time, gods were seen as tribal, as local deities. And if your tribe went into battle against another tribe and you lost, clearly your god wasn't as good as their god. My god's bigger than your god. And so you would abandon your god and worship theirs. That was the culture, that was the context in the ancient Near East. They were conquered, God hasn't come to rescue them. If you can't beat them, join them. That would have been one approach. Another would have been to justify compromise. What Nebuchadnezzar is doing here is he's building unity. He's holding this disparate empire of different nations together. He's not asking people to stop worshipping their own god, just to add this one in as well. And if you're worshipping in a context of polytheism, where there are many, many gods, actually adding an extra one really doesn't make a great deal of difference. You can see that Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego would have been encouraged to see the bigger picture. One person's described the way they might have tried to reason it to them. We all know that the idolatry is bogus. There's nothing real in it except the emperor wishing us to acknowledge his authority. What does it matter if we outwardly bow down to him? It doesn't mean that he controls our heads or our hearts. And if good men like you three, men of proven ability and integrity, if you refuse to bow down and get killed, that will make the situation even worse. Your top people, if you're not there to continue your powerful influence for good at the highest levels of state, what hope is there for the rest of us? And think of your wives, your children. What are they going to do if you throw your life away like this, needlessly? No, you must take part in the ceremony, like everyone else, for our sakes. We need you there in the corridors of power. You can see how compelling that might have been. And we really do need to pray for those Christians in Parliament who are pressured to conform to party politics against their own conscience. A week on Tuesday, Christine prayed about the National Parliamentary Prayer Breakfast. That's happening a week on Tuesday. I should be going, having breakfast with our local MP, getting to know him. But there'll be politicians from all sides of the House coming together to pray. But we need to pray for those who are in those positions of influence, who are often asked to justify compromise. But there is a third alternative, and that is to stand tall and face the consequences. Now, that is very easy to say, well, of course that's what we would do. We fall into that self-righteousness when confronted with a hypothetical evil. But it's much harder when the likely consequence actually is sudden and painful death. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego knew Nebuchadnezzar well enough to know that he has made this threat, he will carry it through. We don't know whether they were amongst those list of officers who got called to the dedication and whether they defied the edict there. But even if they didn't go to that, even if there wasn't this public defiance, there were certainly people around who were jealous of them, who were angry with them, and who were sufficiently opposed to ensure that their peaceful non-compliance would still come before the emperor. They faced a very real threat. They weren't in a position, nobody was in a position to question or challenge the king. He was an absolute ruler. He was a tyrant. He was all-powerful. He was unquestionable. And so when they come before the king, you see, they don't try and argue with him. They say in verse 16, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. We're not going to argue. We're not going to fight you. But we're not going to give in. But Nebuchadnezzar, he sees himself as this all-powerful ruler, and so powerful, in fact, that he says, what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Not what God can rescue you from my God. He's putting himself on that same level. He is making himself out to be a god, able to battle with the other gods. Expecting in answer to that question, well, there is no God that could rescue us from your hand, O mighty king. He had beaten everyone. He'd beaten Israel, Judah. He put himself in the place of God. And that is part of the problem with this statue. It's a problem that continues into the next chapter as Nebuchadnezzar again and again puts himself on a par with God. This idea, no God can defeat me, can defeat my plans. But actually, although we might look at that and go, well, that's clearly wrong, that's clearly rubbish, isn't it actually the way so often we live? We pay lip service to God, we come to church on a Sunday, we worship, we sing, but actually when we go out of this building, we carry on living our lives as if we are the ones who are ultimately in control. We are the ones who can actually determine what is going to happen. And then when things don't quite work according to our plans, we start to struggle. We often live as Nebuchadnezzar is living, not that we build statues and ask people to worship them. But we live as if we actually were the ones in control of at least the world around us. So Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, they're faced with this. They say, we don't need to defend ourselves before you. God is our judge. Which means what Daniel means. He is the one that we give accounts to. So that's how they reply. The God we serve is able to save us. They have a total confidence in God. He is able. He will rescue. God has allowed us to be taken captive to Babylon, and yet he has still blessed us. He blessed us when we've stayed faithful on the seemingly small thing of what we should eat. He'd revealed Nebuchadnezzar's dream to them when their lives were at risk. Surely he wouldn't have done all of that in order for them now to just die. They're confident, but. And there is a but. But even if he does not, we will not serve your God. They're open to the possibility that actually they might die. They're expecting to be thrown in the furnace, and they are saying, well, we know God can, but we don't completely know if he will. But we would rather die than be unfaithful. Within Daniel, we find, perhaps more than most of the rest of the Old Testament, this idea of something beyond this life. Perhaps if there wasn't this perspective that there is something beyond the moment of our physical death here on this earth, there would have been a greater temptation to bow down. But here they have a confidence that God will guard them. God will hold them beyond this life, even if they were to die. And so they will not bow to the wishes of the king. They stand firm. The king is furious. In anger, he arranges for the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter. If he was thinking straight, he might actually have asked for it to be cooler, because that would make a longer and more painful death. But instead, he goes for this extreme heat, instant death, which is what the soldiers throwing them in received. Perhaps trying to give God a greater challenge than forcing him to deal with, give God a greater challenge by forcing him to deal with a really hot furnace. But this is the God who made the sun. He can cope with a furnace. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego find that God's promise through Isaiah is true. He would be with them. What Isaiah says in chapter 43, when you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. For I am the Lord, your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Saviour. The overall context of that passage, God is saying, when it gets really tough, I will be with you. And what do we find in the furnace? There is another figure with them. It might be an angel. It might be a pre-incarnate Jesus. The commentators are much keener to tell us who it was than God was in inspiring the Bible. The Bible does no more here than hint. When Nebuchadnezzar looks at it, he says, one like the Son of God. Hey, must be Jesus. A little later on says, oh, we sent an angel to rescue you. Oh, it's an angel. We don't know. Neither do we know what happens to the other figure. I only noticed this for the first time when I was studying for today. There's 4 figures in the furnace, and who does Nebuchadnezzar call out? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He leaves the other figure in there. Maybe otherwise we would have found out who it was. They're unhurt. The only impact of the fire on them is to burn through their bonds, the ropes that hold them. They don't even smell of smoke. And so Nebuchadnezzar can only respond by acknowledging their God. He's moved from discounting their God to acknowledging him as once amongst many. Now to acknowledging him as perhaps the greatest among many. It still falls short of becoming a disciple. But there is a gradual progression with this king. There is some movement. We'll see that develop more as we go into chapter 4. But this story of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego has connected with persecuted and struggling Jews and Christians through history. A few months ago, Christy and I were in Rome, and while we were there, we went on a visit to the catacombs, which was the graves for the undesirables of early Roman culture, by which it was largely the Christians. They weren't allowed to be buried within the city walls, and so they built these long tunnels with multiple graves in them. And as you go around, there's all sorts of images. Even there, it was difficult to publicly say, we are followers of Jesus Christ. But there was all kinds of imagery. And one of the images that came again and again and again was an image from this of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego coming out of the fiery furnace. It's a story that speaks of resurrection, renewal from certain death. And it inspired hope in them. Not so much a hope of avoiding the grave, the catacombs is probably a little late for that, but a hope that there is something that goes beyond this life, beyond the death that we might face. It became a picture of resurrection and the resurrection life that we can have in Jesus Christ. But the Church of Jesus Christ continues to face opposition and persecution. Now, within this country, that largely consists of mocking, of sidelining of Christians. Unless you want them to do something, and then it's all flattery and telling you how wonderful you are. We saw something of that in the run-up to the last general election by all the political parties. But in other parts of the world, there is a much greater threat, a greater pressure to compromise. These Egyptian Christians in the photograph were killed in the name of Islam, but they refused to compromise or to convert to save their lives. I don't know what I would have done. I like to think I know, but we can't ever be sure until we're there. A book that I recommended a couple of weeks ago by John Lennox called Against the Flow, he talks about a time within that, but when he met a man who had been a prisoner in the Soviet Gulag for being a Sunday school teacher. And as he talks, this man explains about many of the horrors that he'd seen. And as he talks, the man notices that John's face pales at the horror of it all. And he says to him, "You couldn't cope with that, could you?" John Lennox didn't know what to say. He goes, no, I'm sure you're right. And then the man replied with these words. He said, "Nor could I. I was a man who fainted at the sight of his own blood, let alone that of others. But what I discovered in the camp was this. God does not help us face theoretical situations, but real ones. Like you, I couldn't imagine how one could cope in the gulag. But once there, I found that God met me, exactly as Jesus had promised his disciples when he was preparing them for victimization and persecution." Just think about that. God does not help us face theoretical situations, but real ones. And we have brothers and sisters around the world who are facing torture, who are facing death for following Jesus Christ. And yet we're still tempted to compromise to have an easy life. Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego knew that God could save them, but even if he didn't, they wouldn't compromise. They wouldn't bow down to anything or anyone other than the Lord their God. Perhaps this morning you've become aware of somewhere in your life where you have compromised, but shouldn't. We have a God who can forgive those sins when we confess them to him. Or perhaps you've recognized an area in your life where you're tempted to compromise, and you've heard again that challenge to stand firm. but you're not sure if you've got the strength. For each of us, I'm going to give a moment of quiet to bring ourselves and our situation before God. That may be that you need to confess. It may be that you need to ask God for help. It may even be that you recognize a time that God helps you to stand firm. And you need to give thanks to him, even though it was difficult. So take a moment to do business with God. Perhaps after the service you'd like someone to pray with you, or the prayer ministry team will be over there on the right-hand side of the church to pray for you to stand firm, just as Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego stood together.